Welcome, listeners, to another episode of Historical with myself, clinical physician Matt Nelson, and hospital orderly Wayne Bridgman.
Hello, listeners, but I'll just correct that, Matthew. I was not trained as a hospital orderly, as you say, actually.
That's a fitting role?
No. Well, I trained as a gynaecologist, actually, but I, due to a slight misunderstanding in the practical exams, failed them terribly. I can't practice.
That's a shame. That's hence why we're doing the podcast.
Well, in fact, I'm not allowed to come within 500 metres of Royal Barts Hospital, although I can pop in there for a coffee.
Actually, Wayne, I've done you a disservice. You're actually a doctor of comedy.
That's right.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yes. And of course, laughter is the best medicine. Or so they say. So, a big howdy to our American listeners out there, and we hope the US presidential race isn't getting you down too much. I know it's pretty chaotic out there at the moment.
As a follower of politics myself, and my wife, of course, she's American, she follows it. It's must be getting a bit heavy for some who are following it closely these days.
November will come round in no time at all.
But, well, let's hope that it's not getting you down too much. Hopefully, listeners in America, it's not giving you a headache.
Well, if it was, you could simply pop a pill in your mouth, because that would cure the headache, of course.
It could. Well, and have you ever wondered, Matt, though, how much hit-and-miss research got us to a stage where just that simple little pill will cure what ails you?
Ah, that's a clue for you there, listeners. And Wayne, perhaps you have another clue for us all.
Well, let's try. Let's see if a little joke here can give them a clue, the listeners.
Okay.
So, a doctor's out there going about his business, Matt, with a bizarrely rectal thermometer tucked behind his ear. He goes into a staff meeting.
Be smelly.
To discuss the day's activities.
Yep.
And when a co-worker asks why he has a thermometer behind his ear, in a wild motion, the doctor grabs the thermometer, looks at it, and exclaims, "Damn, some asshole has my pen."
Another clue for today's episode. Actually, a friend of mine, his wife, is a nurse at Royal Barks Hospital.
Oh, yes. Okay, great.
And she was going into a patient's room to take some blood, as you do. And she had noticed that there was an apple on the nightstand.
Not strange.
So, you know, making a bit of chit-chat, she said, "An apple a day, hey, keeps the doctor away." And the very pasty-faced ill man said, "That's true, actually. I haven't been to see a doctor for 3 years.
Oh, God.
Well, so, guys, you know, the medical advice is, you know, go and see a doctor if you've got any concerns.
Any lumps, no matter where they are.
Yeah, or of course,
apart from the usual places.
Yeah. So, why don't we now give birth to a new episode of Historical?
Let's do that. We'll get on with it, listeners. So,
right.
If you've not already gleaned from the podcast title, actually, what the subject is, let's help you out here. Have you ever been left with the impression, after a thorough poking, peering at, and possibly testicular cupping, for the lads out there?
Is this at the doctor's office, or is this in your spare time?
This is at the doctor's office. That perhaps those doctors don't always know what they're talking about. Why is the doctor cupping my testicles when I said I had a cold? You might wonder to yourself.
Or why have I never seen this doctor ever in this doctor's before? Doctor's surgery before? Yeah. It doesn't look like a doctor.
Well, perhaps you've pondered to yourself as you lay on your side, with the doctor's latex-gloved finger poised inches from your most intimate area. Surely in 2016, we can come up with a better procedure than this.
I mean, you're thinking to yourself, I only came in for a repeat prescription for my hay fever, for goodness sake. Why have I not seen this doctor before in my visits? Is he really a doctor? Such thoughts are usually pushed from your mind for very sensible reasons. It's an appalling thing to have to think about as you're laying there prone and vulnerable. Because you calm yourself with thoughts like, why worry?
Why worry, yeah.
These guys had to go through years of medical schools and call on large sums from their wealthy parents' money, or got into huge debts to get where they are today.
Very sensible people.
If you can't trust them with your health, Wayne, who can you trust? Trust a doctor.
Don't feel bad, though, listeners, for people who have struggled to push such nagging thoughts from their mind for millennia. Doctors have a long storied background of not really knowing what the hell they're doing.
History is filled with stories of hilarious medical ineptitude. And in all likeliness, today's medical practices will be similarly snorted at it with laughter 100 years down the road from today.
Particularly the prostate exam, of course.
In other words, if you're looking to justify your medical phobia so you can rationalise not getting that ever-growing lump on your neck checked out, you're in the right place. But obviously we don't recommend that. We actually say get to the doctors, check it out. Get beyond your phobia. But this is not the podcast to get you.
I mean, granted, there are doctors out there which are serial killers. But the chances are you've actually got more chance of being killed by your own trousers or a shark than you have by a doctor.
Well, there you go.
Unless it's, a medical problem that's terminal.
Terminal, of course.
But let's not dwell on that, Matt, because in this episode, we're going to be looking at medicine and medical treatments throughout the ages. When I say ages, I mean from when the first heavy-browed Neanderthal grabbed a handful of medicinal plants and shoved them into their grunting mouths, Matt. It's a grunt on mouth for you there.
There we go. That's right, my best through, impression of it.
Right through to the 19th century and the building blocks of modern medicine.
Now, some of our more bloodthirsty listeners, and we know you're out there because we hear from you regularly, may be frowning at their phones or their audio devices, thinking, that sounds pretty boring. Where is all the fighting and the action? Well, fear not, for we will be taking a look at battlefield surgery. Yes, warfare too. And we'll investigate some of the horrifying tools and techniques used by these butchers.
Really horrifying.
But actually, there's a butcher and a doctor in battlefield technology and warfare.
There wasn't that
difference, was it? So whether it is a caveman's cold, a Roman soldier's slashed stomach,
a plague sufferer's buboed butt,
or a Confederate blunderbust butt cheek, we will be telling you their tale. So grab a handful of ginger to settle your stomach.
Yeah,
of course.
It works. It does work.
You know, as the druids would have told us. And prepare to be transfixed in horrid fascination.
You could well be transfixed if you're not careful, hey listeners. Who knows, though? Maybe you'll learn of a new free natural cure to fight a common ailment. They are out there, and we'll tell you about them. Maybe you'll be thinking of us next time you're feeling down. Well, or
perhaps, as we said before, laughter is the best medicine. Probably isn't, though. I'd imagine it's some kind of multivitamin supplement.
Well, it could be, yeah. Or you could be thinking of us next time you're vomiting violently into the toilet bowl that you wish you'd cleaned the day before. Could this be our final podcast?
Oh, no, yeah,
because
could be.
Because I'm giving you this invaluable knowledge, listeners. Maybe Matt and I will be sued into oblivion by enraged pharmaceutical giants. Maybe we
wait a second. You never told me about this. What
enraged pharmaceutical giants, Matt?
Why would they be enraged, Wayne?
Well, you know, I mean, we're going to spill the beans on.
Well, should we?
Yeah, spill the beans on how they've suppressed natural remedies so they can charge a fortune for their manufactured pills, you see? Oh, and then you forgot. Allegedly.
Yeah. So definitely allegedly. This we haven't talked about this suing.
Apparently, if we say that after everything, allegedly, we're fine. Dave, our lawyer friend, told me anyway.
So. Okay. Well, I thought Dave settled disputes about cat pedigrees. You've never done that stuff.
Whatever. No, anyway, we digress.
Allegedly. Allegedly. Allegedly.
No, we definitely digress.
Yeah.
So where did medicine all start, Matt? Well, the latest frontier in the exciting and glamorous world of Neanderthal research, something that's very close to my heart.
Mm-hmm. Well, something you're very close to genetically, I think.
Something that I'm just very close to generally.
Listeners, if you look up the pictures of Wayne, you'll see there's a similarity.
Yeah, sort of the same sort of sturdy frame as a Neanderthal. That's where any likeliness ends. it's not the artifacts that these Neanderthals left behind, or their ham-fisted cave paintings either, really. No, it's the gunk that stuck to their horse-like teeth that we're interested in here, Matt.
Really?
Because, yes, in 2012, a variety of chemical analyses of Neanderthal chompers' teeth revealed that our lovable ape-like ancestors did actually consume medicinal plants, Matt.
Well, apparently, chemicals embedded in the calcified plaque of these five Neanderthals that they found.
Yeah.
Okay, and they dated
what sort of age
these.
Were
well, they carbon dated these guys to 47,300 BC. All the way to 50,600 BC.
That's pretty old.
But they showed that these guys had, or girls, we don't know.
Presumably they were girls as well.
They're both, you know, it's...
maybe that's what they died out.
You know, you know, presume that that sort of business went on in those days. That these guys and girls had eaten cooked plant foods, including bitter-tasting medicinal plants such as chamomile and yarrow. Now, why this is important is it shows that the fact these things were bitter-tasting shows that they did not eat them for pleasure.
Yeah.
It boggles the mind, Wayne. Boggles the mind. I feel boggled. To think of how these supposedly dumb Neanderthals with
brain the size of a walnut, wasn't
brains
it?
Brains the size of a walnut. Yeah. Exactly. Could essentially perform Neanderthal clinical trials and understand that plants had different qualities in terms of how they would help human health.
With that in mind, then, we know that prehistoric medicine incorporated plants. Herbalism, isn't it?
Yeah, herbalism. That's right, yeah.
Or herbalism. To our American listeners, they dropped the H. It's herb, not herb.
For them, it's my... I also saw the people in the North of England. Herbalism?
They can, yes.
For example, for... is that a Brummie accent? Or we don't really know what it is.
I'm not sure what that was.
Herbs.
Okay, we'll move on from our wild speculation as to the pronouncement of herbs or herbs now. We also know that prehistoric medicine utilised animal parts.
Bulls.
No, it's true.
Is it?
plus minerals were used as well. In many cases, these minerals were used ritually as magical substances, Matt, by priests, shamans, or medicine men. Note this name there, medicine men. It's clear that prehistoric societies believed in both natural and some of those crazy supernatural means of variably causing and treating disease.
Awareness of medical conditions in the Stone Age may have been more advanced than you think, Wayne.
Because I think they're pretty unadvanced.
Let me change your mind. For merely 1 year ago, in 2015, evidence of the world's earliest dental operation was discovered in the 14,000-year-old chompers of a caveman suffering from toothache.
Well, this isn't going to be good, is it?
Researchers in Italy discovered that a tiny little flint tool called a microlift was used to file away a rotting cavity to halt an infection.
Oh, I see.
Just like a modern dentist drill. The research coordinator from the University of Bologna.
That's in Spain.
Explains. Listeners, we just have to explain to you that one little sentence has been six times I've tried to
Bologna.
Read that out. Bologna. And it was Bologna. Explains. They explain this.
But we've cut it out for your own benefit.
Yeah. There was a lot of laughter involved in that. But okay. So, the research coordinator from the University of Bologna explains.
The discovery... Hey, can I speak here? The discovery shows that the man from the end of the Paleolithic, or early Stone Age, period, was aware of the damaging nature of an infected cavity and the need to intervene with microlift tools to remove the infections.
So next time you're sitting in the dentist waiting room, listeners, just be thankful you're not 9,000 years in the past waiting for some hairy Neolithic doctor to unleash his flint-tipped hand drill on your chattering chompers.
Well, actually, Wayne, I always used to have a fantasy to go back in time. You know, I love the Roman era. I always wanted to go back in time and live.
Be a dentist.
just live in ancient Rome. But then it dawned on me that actually medicine's the thing, isn't it? You'd go back there, you think, I live in ancient Rome. I've got no dentist. and I've got no medical...
It spoils the romance for me.
You'd be ill. You'd be terrible. Yeah. You'd smell, you'd decay.
The most simple of wounds. You know, an infection these days, we get an infection and have a few antibiotics and 3 or 4 days later, you're skipping happily down the road. No problem at all. We take all that for granted heavily. But, of course, in those days...
We live in the best time. We live in the best time, listeners. We don't even...
From a medical point of view.
We may think to ourselves, yes, I'd like to live in a toga in ancient Rome, but you really, you wouldn't.
Yes.
Trust me, you wouldn't.
You could have some sort of horrible, hideous, disfiguring facial disease that can't be cured. Just remember that. That's a very important point. Okay, so let's move on.
In early human history, common maladies such as colds or your nemesis, Wayne, constipation... and of course your other nemesis, their close cousins, diarrhoea, or the shits.
I feel like I should step in here, listeners, and say my
accepted
bowels are absolutely fine.
Yeah, these were accepted, Wayne, which you'll be glad to know, as part of everyday existence.
Oh, good.
And dealt with by such means as herbal remedies. Serious and disabling diseases, however, were placed in a very different category. Very different indeed. These were usually deemed to be of a supernatural origin. They might be the result of a spell cast upon the victim by some enemy.
Yeah, well, go back and see or listen to episode 11, Witchcraft, listeners.
When will we free meet again?
Possibly in a future episode.
Yeah, you never know. And a visitation, for example, by a malevolent demon.
Much like the dreaded flatulent demon that sometimes haunts your arse. Not a pleasant beast.
That got me back for the constipation comment earlier. Indeed, or some serious, in some serious illness could be due to the work of an offended god who had projected, stroke fired, an object like a dart, a stone or a worm into the body of a victim.
It's a strange thing to project, isn't it? A worm?
But these were superstitious people. And they fired these things into the body of the victim.
Well, of course they had,
or had abstracted something.
Well, they had no sort of concept of microbiology, or they, you know, had the worm get into the person.
Well,
they didn't realise that drinking a bit of water could give you a nasty little ringworm.
The only way it could have got in is through the malevolent, angry god.
Maybe they're right.
But the god had extracted something from the person, usually the soul of the patient. The treatment then applied was to try and lure the errant soul back to its proper habitat within the body, or extract the evil intruder.
Oh.
In this case, the worm, I guess.
Or a dart, or a demon.
Yeah. By counter spells, incantations, potions, suction, or other dramatic means.
Right, okay.
You know, so...
One curious ancient method of providing a disease with a means of escape from the body was by making a little hole. About 2.5 to 5 centimetres across. Doesn't seem that big until you hear what the hole is in. Because the hole is in the skull of the patient / victim.
You should have probably put a little warning not to be eating your dinner while listening to this podcast.
Well, you've probably heard about this, haven't you? This is called tree panning, or tree fining is another word for it. The tree panned skulls of these prehistoric and later patients, in fact, have been found in Britain, France, other parts of Europe, and in Peru as well. All across the world, really. Many of them show evidence of these holes healing, and presumably, therefore, Matt, the patient's survival.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
The practice still exists among some tribal people still, Matt, today, in parts of Algeria. Yes, there are tribes in Algeria. Also in Melanesia, and perhaps elsewhere as well. Though, thankfully, it is fast becoming an extinct practice. Now that people understand that they can just pop a paracetamol in their mouths instead. Much easier.
Historically, trepanation was most commonly used as treatment for seizures and migraines.
Migraines.
Ouch. You know, you got pain in your head? Just drill a hole in your head. Ouch. Surprise, surprise, having a gaping hole drilled into your skull.
Usually without anaesthesia.
Did very little to help people's headaches or brain issues.
Well.
Trepanation was also used as an extreme form of cosmetic experimental body modification among several societies, such as the Incas and the Mayans.
Strange bunch.
These societies also got largely wiped out.
I wonder why.
And then a few hundred years later suffered the indignity of having insulting Mel Gibson make a movie about them. So it didn't really work out too well, did it?
No,
and Apocalypto, of course. Oh, worth a watch.
Very violent, though, listeners. If you're a bit squeamish, very gory. Be careful. Prior to the modern or enlightened era, as it's known, of medicine, you may have already heard, listeners, of some of the crazy and sometimes downright dangerous cures that were flying about in the 19th century. So before we go back and look at some of the more distant history of medicine, Matt, we just want to reflect a little bit on the Victorian age in particular.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And partly because it's some of the most fun cures were. We'll come back to it later, but simply because it's hilarious in many ways. When you see what humans can convince themselves of in the quest for health.
Yeah, I mean, take children's medicine, for example, listeners, Wayne.
Cowpole, that sort of thing.
Yeah, Medistead. However, these days we have to take a chill pill after worrying ourselves sick about which medicines we should give our children.
Yeah.
There's quite a few. Yeah. Should we vaccinate? Should we not? You know, this was a big thing when my son was...
MRSA,
quite
for example.
MRSA, yeah. Exactly. Should we increase vitamin A intake by 5% to give them a better chance of being as close to genetically perfect as possible, and so on?
Yes, very careful. Well, this is a far cry, Matt, from looking after the poor kids in the 19th century. In those days, people were simply too busy churning butter, thwacking rugs with a sort of big pretzel on a stick, tending cattle, or changing in and out of 15 layers of undergarments every time they wanted to take a piss. Too busy doing that to be bothered with disobedient or unruly children. So, to aid the stressed and overworked 19th century mother, they're on the go all day, Matt, a series of soothing syrups, lozenges and powders were created for the littlest members of the family.
Now, I can imagine you all thinking that, some of you... people there that have to work full time, and you've got them home, the kids are all, you know, really excited to see you. Oh, I would, you know, give them a nice soothing lozenge to
pop a lozenge in the mouth. Yeah. Brilliant.
So, Wayne, did these Victorians ensure such potions that they were to give their children were subjected to the British standards, safety regulations that you would expect in today's laboratories?
You mean rigorous safety tests?
Yeah, safety tests and regulations.
Oh,
yeah.
Not really. They pumped each bottle full of as many narcotics as it could hold. For instance, ounce...
That's about 30 grams, listeners.
Yeah, 30 grams. Of Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup, very soothing, contained a cool 65 milligrams of pure morphine.
Whoa, that's going to make old Timmy a sleepy boy.
Well, it does exactly what it says on the bottle. It's a soothing syrup.
Based on our own experiences, teething and casual experimentation with pure morphine, that seems to be like a lot of drug to be shoving into tiny little Timmy's system. Eventually, in 1910, the New York Times decided the whole narcotic, crammed baby concept was very likely not a great thing to persist with. I mean, funny that. And ran an article pointing out that several of these soothing syrups contained, and I'm not making this up, morphine sulfate, chloroform, morphine hydroxide, codeine, heroin.
That's a big one.
And cannabis indica. And sometimes they actually had several of these in each of the syrups in combination.
Wow, well, no wonder people looked weird in old photographs.
They were off their faces.
They're all tweaking, dude.
High as kites.
That said, you can't say these soothing syrups weren't effective, as long as you didn't mind your toddler being strung out on the midnight oil or, you know, dead.
That's right.
I'm afraid so, Matt. Yes. The terrible twos...
Oh, yeah.
...weren't just a cutesy euphemism back then, I'm afraid. Kids were not only at their brattiest, but also at their deadest those days.
Bad.
And in many cases, they died after their parents tried to cure the aforementioned brattiness, you know, the hyperactivity and stuff, with these narcotic concoctions that we talk about.
Yeah.
Some of them that would give Ozzy Osbourne a nosebleed.
Yeah, I mean, it must make members of the Rolling Stones blush, some of this stuff. Now, listeners, I'm sure you would have thought at one time or another...
Allegedly.
I really fancy A cheeky little bit of mercury.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, Mercury, for those who don't know...
And we're not talking about Freddie Mercury, the ill-fated demise of the Queen.
Well, we'd all
have
a bit of Freddie, wouldn't we?
Well, not... No, well, not...
No, Mercury, for those who don't know, is a liquid metal element. You know, the stuff that you see in thermometers and barometers, that sort
yes.
of thing.
Yes, and mercury is pretty cool stuff.
Very cool.
Yeah, and according to the 19th century guys and girls, simply delicious to drink. Mmm. The shiny, silvery liquid has fascinated humans for a millennia.
Yes, there's evidence people used it. When I say used it, you'll see what we mean in a minute. As early as 1500 BC. They were loving a bit of mercury.
It was also known as quicksilver. Of course, this cool liquid was raised to new levels of fame thanks to the evil shape-shifting cop in Terminator 2.
Yeah, is it the T-1000?
The T-1000. Mm. How could such an awesome chemical element, though, not be good for you? Well, it's silver. It must be good.
It looks
silver's
great.
Valuable. It must be valuable to your body.
Well, that was the belief for a long time. Many, many centuries, in fact. Millennia, some might say, because that's the truth. In the olden days, mercury was used to treat pretty much anything and everything, really. Cut your arm. Just rub a little bit of mercury on there, Matt. That'll help it.
Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic. Having some problems with your bowels clogging up. I'm not going to try this.
Forget dried apricots, then, I presume.
Yeah, it's time to get some mercury up there.
Oh.
Why not? Boom. If you lived more than 100 years ago, you simply weren't considered healthy if you weren't leaking silver from at least one orifice.
Oh.
What a wonder drug, you would have thought.
Yes, you would have thought that. But there was only one tiny issue with mercury, though.
Oh, what's that?
It's devastatingly toxic.
Oh, right.
The symptoms of mercury poisoning include chest pains,
right.
Heart and lung problems,
oh.
Coughing,
yeah.
Tremors, violent spasms
oh,
of
God.
The muscles, psychotic reactions, ooh. Delirium... Hallucinations and,
jeez.
Of course, suicide tendencies.
Wow, that's
not the band, actual feelings of suicide.
Well, I mean, either way, it's pretty bad.
Yeah.
That is awful stuff. I mean, what were they thinking?
I haven't even finished. It gets worse. There's also twitching giblet syndrome.
Oh, no.
Testicular rotation.
Oof.
And the good old anal implosion.
What?
Yeah. I just made the last few up, actually.
Oh,
but
God.
They barely looked out of place in the list of horror show that I just read out to you, really.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Wow.
It's, mercury, it ain't good.
That's crazy, isn't it? Well, it's a testament to just how cool a substance mercury was seen as being, that people kept trying to cure stuff with it for 1,000 years after everybody who ingested it dropped dead. What were they thinking? Well,
what were they thinking?
Why don't we go back and find out what they may have been thinking. Oh, hello, Gerald. The head of my fleet. You've been away for so long, months at sea. Come on in. Come on in.
Aye, it's good to be back. Me balls be bursting for Mrs. Miggins pie. No one handles a good filling like she does. Oh, pork pies.
Okay. Now, Gerald. Gerald, it's great to have you back, Gerald. Great to have you back. Now, but I must say, you do look rather ashen-faced, my good man. I expect you to be a bit more tanned all those months at sea.
Well,
what
my
troubles
lord.
You?
Well, my lord. It be Earl Gubbins of Banbury, lord.
Oh.
He had a slightly swollen finger a couple of weeks ago, lord. Oh, it was awful.
I see. Well, I trust my doctor was able to treat him for it.
Oh, yes, Lord. Your doctor, he prescribed he pour a pint of mercury...
Excellent.
...down his gullet, be twice a day, before spinning 3 times, counterclockwise, while balancing a stunned shrew on his head. Oh, yes, he did, Lord, on his head.
Excellent, excellent. You know, that man's a genius, a shrew. How shrewd.
Oh.
Well, you know, I'm lucky to have such a skilled medical professional in my court. Only last month, you know, Gerald, he treated my jester's whooping cough by having him thrash himself repeatedly with a birch branch before injecting mercury into his humour hole, don't ask, and cramming blessed dog biscuits into his mouth.
Oh, that be very clever, my lord. Very clever. Did he get better, my lord?
No. He died. But
oh.
No matter. What of old Gubbins? Is he better now?
Oh, no, my lord. I'm afraid he is another member of your court to have perished, lord.
Yeah.
The autopsy showed he had. It was called the Silver Liver Syndrome. Not even the gallons of wickedly awesome mercury could bring him back to health, my lord.
Oh. Well, that's really very worrying, yes. Well, look, everyone, I mean, we don't want to get ill ourselves, so let's all have a glass of mercury to protect ourselves. Mercury yeah. for everyone!
Oh, ah, perfect.
So let that be a warning to you, listeners. Don't drink too much mercury. Now, since the first ape man spluttered in another ape man's mouth-breathing face, coughs have always plagued primates, Matt. The late 19th century people apparently took cough suppression very seriously.
They weren't monkeying around.
No, very seriously. We're talking time to take a very dangerous drug level serious here.
Well, we know Victorians were sticklers for social etiquette.
Oh, they were.
So wheezing and hacking was probably considered frightfully rude.
Hmm.
But we can't imagine that you'd be tying off your arm and shooting some horse in the middle of a dinner party. I don't think that would go very well, and of course...
We should say that horse is actually slang for heroin, of course.
But Wayne, how did heroin then come into play as a medicine?
Well, we should say, listeners, that heroin is obviously a terrible drug, disclaimer here, and destroys lives. So please don't take this podcast in any way as a green light to swap a little throat lozenge for some skag.
Yeah, we have this problem all the time. Yeah, don't say the guys at Historical
angry
made
parents.
You take skag.
Yeah, I mean, it's not cost effective for one.
Yes.
Heroin, by the way, was originally developed by Bayer. And that was a 19th century version of a sort of a pharmaceutical giant.
Oh, yeah, Bayer, of course.
Bayer,
yeah.
The
we
same,
all know Bayer.
Yeah, the same chaps you have to thank for the harmless aspirin.
And nothing to do with chasing the dragon.
That's right, and...
Of course, another slang for...
That's right, heroin. That's still the heroin.
Yeah.
Not literally.
Just, yeah, well...
And while we're dragging names of dangerous giant companies...
Comes with the podcast.
That would sue you as soon as look at you through the mud. We should also mention that Bayer used to be called IG Farben.
Why is that relevant, though?
Well, they were a pharmaceutical and chemical conglomerate that allegedly sponsored experiments by Nazi torturers.
That in the adverts, do they?
Mm. Mm.
Now then, if you were struggling to get your man's member, okay, to function as it should, maybe the next remedy can help.
Okay, a few ears
men.
Pricking up out
yeah,
there.
Yeah, all the men there listening in. Hello, right, get the old notepad out. Here we go. Lick the pen. Okay, fire away, historical. Tell me how to get a lift. In the late 19th century, the wonders of electricity were gifted to the world.
Oh,
fantastic.
Yes.
Illumination. Could this marvellous new technology be used to light up the bedroom?
Mm.
Victorians certainly tried. Electrified beds, elaborate cock-shocking electric belts, and other strange devices were advertised as being able to return male power, or i.e. your libido, and prowess by making your member rise to electrified attention like Frankenstein's 6-inch tall monster.
Well, what's fascinating is that you can find ads. Go Google it, you can find ads. Type in cock shocking belt.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not accountable for what you get back.
Yeah.
You can find ads for more than one brand of electric dick shock belt. Go and Google it.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to indicate that the dick shock belt industry
mm-hmm.
somehow survived the negative press that surely came...
Or failed to come.
...from the first todger-tasing belt. Shocking stuff. And yeah. not in a good way.
Well, I find that hard to swallow. But another very popular medical procedure for crazy, cure-loving Victorians, of course, was good old bloodletting.
Oh, yes.
We know it.
We love a bit of
bloodletting, of
course.
We even admire it. This procedure was actually one of the most enduring and popular medical practices in history,
yeah.
of course. It was originated by the Greeks and used up until the 19th century for, well, basically everything. Everything. If you were feeling rough back in the day, it was very likely because you had too much bloody blood in your system, and so you better get rid of some of your blood and you feel better.
Why, though? Well, for centuries, Matt, centuries this is, the theory of the four humours persisted.
Yes, this is Cleese,
No, we're not talking
Pythons,
not talking Monty
the Monty Pythons.
Pythons.
You
no,
know,
basically the theory was that the body, this is your body, was filled with four fluids.
Yeah.
Blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile, called humours.
Okay, let's just repeat that again. So we've got
blood,
phlegm, yellow bile,
black bile. What the hell is that?
Okay, the four horsemen of the apocalypse,
the humours.
The humours, right, okay.
These were supposed to be in balance, these humours, and any imbalance in those four, they thought in those days, was the root of all illness. So,
right, okay.
According to doctors in the olden days, blood can be, well, let's just say, a little bit of a space hog. And thus, some often has to be bled out to make room for one or more of the other three humours, you see.
Right, okay, so blood...
Get rid of the blood. Get the phlegm in.
Okay, right. So there was also some useful cures out there for what we call female hysteria.
Oh.
Okay. Women and their mood swings, right, guys? Okay. You know what we're saying? Mm-hmm. Okay, ladies. No offence, men, of course. If you happen to be female, don't be offended by this. There's no shame in admitting to the occasional bit of moodiness.
We'll do it.
According to the 19th century doctors, it's a symptom of a deadly serious medical condition.
Oh. Well, along with other female mental symptoms, such as apparently nervousness, irritability, these are real symptoms, and the dreaded tendency to cause trouble.
Women know your place. Yes, that's right, ladies. You may be victims of female hysteria and you don't even know it. Mm. How can you be treated? Wayne, how can we treat these poor people?
Well, women, you guys have not garnered as much respect...
Or girls.
...as much respect as you should have throughout history, as we all know. Especially considering it was a woman...
Queen Victoria, of course.
That's right, who literally straddled the most expansive empire in history. Victorian husbands were notorious, really, for wanting to keep the fairer sex in their place. So, exactly how do you cure a so-called condition that coincidentally was diagnosed almost entirely to women who dared disobey their Victorian husbands? How do you do that? Well, the prescription for female hysteria, this was a recognised condition, was usually a good spot.
Oh, I'm getting worried about this.
Of doctor administered, was perfectly natural, Matt. Don't let it panic you.
Yep.
A good spot of doctor administered vaginal massage. Now, this was a real thing.
Oh, my God.
They did this until the women achieved something called hysterical paroxysm.
Well, why not try it at home, listeners, if you've not already, of course. Anyhow, moving forwards.
Backwards and forwards.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. Okay. The cure for female hysteria, okay, was a doctor's hands... down your bloomers. Oh. Is it any wonder the list of symptoms for female hysteria was so long? Literally any ailment could fit the diagnosis. In those very sexually repressed times, visiting the doctor's office must have been like a trip to Disneyland for most women. Now, male listeners, before you decide to get in a teleportation device, go back to Victorian times and retrain as a doctor... The doctors of the day apparently objected to the woman's frequent desire to be cured by their magical fingers. Maybe it just got a bit repetitive or something like that. Who knows? So their solution to alleviate hand strain...
What could they have done?
They invented the vibrator.
Ah, okay.
And thus, this introduction comes to a happy ending. Or happy end.
Well, that's interesting fact there, listeners. So how did we arrive at these odd Victorian cures? How did we get to this? Let's go back now and look at some of the origins. Was the medicine that was developed in the previous millennia really so bad that we had to resort to these sort of desperate measures? Or did we just lose our way somehow, Matt? Where did it all start?
Magic and religion played an extensive part in the medicine of prehistoric and early human society in general.
It did.
Administration of a vegetable drug or remedy by mouth was accompanied by incantations, dancing, grimaces, and other
I find
other tricks of the magician stroke the doctor. Yep. Magician stroke the doctor, of course, mm-hmm. not just the doctor. Therefore, the first doctors or medicine men
yeah.
were witch doctors or sorcerers. Until the Egyptians came along, all we really had to go on in terms of medical evidence is a few bones, teeth, and the remains of a horrific surgical tools and such like. But with the rise of civilizations in the Middle East and Egypt, we begin to see written records and other dramatic visual representations, such as, I guess, hieroglyphics, mm-hmm. of the medical arts. So without further ado, let's take a look at some of the some genuine evidence from these times.
Yes, the ancient Egyptians had a remarkably well-organised medical system, actually, Matt.
Well, of course, we're talking about the people that mummified people, so...
Yeah, they knew about the body, didn't they?
They certainly did.
Complete with doctors who specialised in healing specific ailments. Nevertheless, the cures they prescribed weren't always up to snuff.
We've got things up to snuff is unfortunate. okay, because you often end up dead.
Yeah. We've got things like lizard blood...
Yeah.
Classic. Dead mice, very good, of course.
Yeah.
Muddy, sort of mud and mouldy bread
mm-hmm.
were all used as topical ointments and dressings. Must have stunk a little bit there.
Yeah.
And women were sometimes dosed with horse saliva.
Oh, that's disgusting.
As a cure for an impaired libido.
Yeah, snog a horse. That'll get you thinking rude thoughts.
There's nothing like a bit of horse saliva to get you in the mood, Matt. That's what I always say.
Jesus.
If any of you listeners can't afford Viagra, why not give horse saliva a go? I mean, what's the worst that can
stables,
happen?
Give old Mr. Ed a little wipe down.
Careful how you obtain it, because people might ask questions.
Yeah. RSPCA. Most disgusting of all, civilised Egyptians, we use civilised in inverted commas, Egyptian physicians use human and animal...
What?
Excrement.
What?
Excrement... Listeners, as a cure-all remedy for diseases and injuries. I mean, surely that's just crap, isn't it? That's a shit cure. According to 1500 BC's Eder's Papyrus, they used donkey, dog,
what?
Gazelle, and fly dung.
Fly dung? Yeah. Bull.
No, they didn't use bull.
Oh, they didn't.
They were all celebrated for their healing properties. And their ability to ward off bad spirits.
Ward off most things. Huh?
So who is cheerily sampling all this dung? It worries me now how many animal dung were sampled before the prize poop of these animals was settled upon. I mean, what makes a good stool? None of us have really thought about that, have we? I mean, fly dung, for example, is pretty small. I mean, who is going around... licking up the lovely bit of fly dung, you know?
Do flies even have dung? I don't know.
I don't know. It must take a lot of harvesting to get a decent sample.
Well, why not camel dung?
Yeah, I can't help feeling the Egyptians missed out on an obvious one there, really. Yeah. They must have the hump.
Well, I mean, how could they believe this? What a load of crap.
It is.
As you may expect, literally, there's a load of crap, all different types. Yeah. As you may expect, listeners, these repugnant... But harvested remedies may have often led to tetanus and other infections. Horrible.
That's really bad, isn't it? Yeah.
So let's try and visualise this now, shall we? Imagine yourself, listeners, back in an Egyptian hospital. Picture in your mind's eye a poor patient suffering from an unpleasant bout of rickets. Okay, who is next? You there, sitting in the corner. Okay, hello. Time to see the doctor.
Oh, good, good. These rickets, they're really uncomfortable.
Wait. What's that around your mouth? Is that chocolate?
No. I've been eating horse shit.
What?
Yeah, horse shit. Yeah, you know, to make me feel better. I've self-diagnosed myself. I mean, I picked it up from the pharmacy. Well, just outside the pharmacy. I mean, I literally picked it off the ground. I've been eating it for about 3 days now.
Eating horse dung.
Yes. I mean, it doesn't taste great, as they say. But a spoonful of sugar helps medicine go down.
Do you have any sugar?
No. I mean, I would really like to see the doctor.
Okay,
to be all honest.
Right. Okay, wait, please.
God, my breath's awful.
Wait, please. Wait.
My breath smells of shit.
Okay, okay. He'll see you now. In you go. In you go. Hello. Come in. Come in. Sit. Sit down. Take a seat.
Thank you very much.
Now, the a bit concerned for your health here. The nurse tells me you've been eating horse dung. Is that right?
Yes, yes. I mean, quite a lot. I mean, quite a few stalls.
Well, why would you do that? Are you ill or something?
Yes, I've got rickets. I told you, that's why.
Horse dung? Well,
what, no. What's funny about that?
No. You're supposed to put it on your skin, you see. Like an ointment, not eat the bloody thing.
No,
camel piss. Camel piss, that's another story. Take 3 spoonfuls of camel piss a day before meals and your rickets. Glowing will be a thing of the past. Hey, hang on. Hey, what are you doing?
I'm eating horse shit.
Why? Why are you eating that?
I got a bit of a taste of it. I quite like it. We jest, of course, but Egyptians do actually have some major kudos in developing medicine. Mm. Due to the hot and dry climate in Egypt, ancient papyri have survived intact, allowing historians to study the sophisticated techniques employed by ancient Egyptian physicians. Mm. Whilst couched in magic and ritual, the Egyptians possessed a great deal of knowledge of healing herbs and repairing physical injuries. Mm-hmm. Amongst the normal population and the workers responsible for building the great monuments, such as the pyramids, and controversially maybe the Sphinx. In fact, the Sphinx could actually be carbon dated 10,000 years before. It's causing a lot of issues actually in Egypt.
And of course,
the
Sphinx is the first gender neutral, isn't it, out there, as far as we know?
Is it?
It is. Yes. Take a look at it. It's got breasts and balls.
Okay.
Indeed.
Moving on.
modern research has shown that these builders, remember the pyramid builders, etc., that we talked about, they weren't actually slaves at all, Matt.
What?
This is a news break. This isn't just my opinion, this is modern thinking now. Okay. They were actually highly respected and well-treated free men.
Okay.
Like the modern contractors and construction workers of today. The care and treatment given for injuries and afflictions for these guys, you know, they're obviously the dangerous work they do, was centuries ahead of its time. Early paid retirement, if you were very badly injured at work, Matt, you had.
It's not bad.
Have you been injured at work? If the answer is yes for these guys,
could be an advert, of course, an Egyptian advert for injuries we could have done there, actually.
They've got injury lawyers for you. Have you been crushed by a 20-ton stone at work? If the answer is yes, they could retire. They can get paid for it.
Fantastic.
They also got sick leave. That was another one of those sort of far-sighted policies that were adopted by the Egyptian ancient medicine practitioners.
Yeah, very impressive.
Such luxuries, actually, would rarely be enjoyed by most workers until well into the 20th century. So they were ahead of their time again here.
Well, the Egyptians also made sure their labourers, the lucky devils, were fed on a rich diet of radish, garlic and good old onion.
Well, of course, garlic has very good antibacterial properties.
But bad for the breath, though. Radish, garlic and onion combo. Woo! Which helps modern researchers have found to be extremely rich in, and it's a plate. I know you're a fan of this, raffin.
You've got something called raffin. You've got allicin's another one, and allostatin. Yeah. As I say, listeners, if you roast a couple of garlic bulbs in the oven and quite literally eat that with something, but don't do anything for the next day.
This is clearly not a great recipe. It's just eat some roasted garlic.
Apparently that would be as good.
Spread it on some bread, of course, a nice... Bruschetta. It's quite nice.
That would be as good as having antibiotics for 2 or 3 days.
This is becoming a cooking program.
So just bear that one in mind.
Yeah. So these compounds, the same word repeated again, provided powerful natural antibiotics,
which would
certainly help to prevent outbreaks of disease in the often overcrowded conditions of these worker camps, because there must have been thousands of them used to do this.
The Egyptian physicians grew upon a great store of knowledge in something called the Peri-Ankh, the Houses of Life.
Mm.
Here, students were taught and papyri documenting procedures were stored. Such procedures included...
Physiotherapy and heat therapy were used to treat aches and pains, pretty similar to today.
That's right, very good. Repairing and splinting broken bones, as shows by successfully healed skeletons.
Priests and doctors also practice amputation, mm-hmm. using linens and antiseptics to reduce the chance of infection and the dreaded gangrene.
Oof, nasty. Plus, there's also evidence that they employed prosthetic limbs.
Interesting. Well, anecdotal evidence shows that the ancient Egyptian physicians adopted the ethical code centuries before the Hippocratic Oath, with one such inscription stating that never did I do evil towards any person on the tomb of Nenkerth Sekhmet, chief of the physicians during the 5th century dynasty. So what is the Hippocratic Oath?
Well, that's something that... doctors take today. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a bit of a you're saying, I dedicate myself to my role and to my patients, that sort of thing. It's had oranges there.
It had its oranges back in Egypt. Its origins. Yeah.
So the information remaining about the medicines and herbs used by Egyptian physicians is remarkable, actually, Matt. While some of the most outlandish cures had little effect, many of the herbs they used have been shown to have positive effects upon ailments, and are still used by modern herbalists today, thousands of years later. So this is where we're going to start talking about a few of the items that you might have in your cupboard that can give you great health benefits.
Okay, so get a pen and paper here, listeners, because we'll start off with honey.
Ah, yes.
Now, honey is an excellent antiseptic, you may or may not be aware, used to treat wounds, and an ancient cure that is now increasingly used by the British military to treat burns.
But beware, because it could reduce the impact of a burn, but could attract wasps, which is, has its own issues.
So,
next one? Willow.
Ah.
Willow. So, it's willow, weeping willow tree, for example.
Yep.
A concoction of this was used to treat toothache. So if there's an apocalypse, listeners, and you've got toothache, go out and get a willow tree, get some willow bark. That also formed the basis of modern aspirin.
Mm.
What else we got?
Well, that sounds a mint solution. And mint, indeed, was used to treat gastric ailments, as it is still today.
It is.
Had a big meal, listeners, you're feeling a bit stuffed, have a nice mint tea.
That's right, spearmint tea, very good for the guts.
The mint is another cure that is still, as we say, used today.
It is.
Yeah.
And another one, slightly left field, this one, is our old friend, the pomegranate.
Oh, yes. A trusted companion.
Yeah, I always have one in my pocket.
Yeah.
That's used to treat infestations of parasitic worms.
That's why you have one in your pocket all the time.
Back to the constipation.
It's the constipation the course of diarrhoea.
Yeah, and actually modern scientists have found that it's got a very high tannin content as well in this fruit, which does paralyse worms. Interesting, isn't it? Known to these sort of worms that you have in your digestive tract are used to known to ancient Egyptian medicine as snakes of the digestive system.
The ancient Egyptians also practiced dentistry and were fully aware of draining abscesses, extracting teeth, and even making false teeth. Although we probably would amuse ourselves at what a set of Egyptian false teeth look like when they're in the mouth. Probably quite toothy. Imagine.
Yeah, a bit like a camel.
Yeah.
The Egyptian physicians knew how to suture wounds as well. So by placing raw meat upon the wound to aid healing and stimulate blood production. You can still do that today, but make sure it's clean.
Whatever you do,
They also used honey, as we said, known for its antiseptic qualities and its ability to stimulate the secretion of infection-fighting white blood cells, very important. And ancient Egyptian priest doctors used mouldy bread as an antibiotic. But before you scoff, listeners, remember that Fleming discovered penicillin based on mould, didn't he?
And that was thousands of years later. Mm. So the Egyptians ahead of their time. Much of the Egyptian knowledge of physiology undoubtedly derived from their practice of embalming the dead.
Ooh.
You know, they're used to taking bodies apart.
Creepy.
Bit by bit. Which allowed them to study the structure of the body. Mm. Makes sense? They made some accurate observations about which part of the body was responsible for certain tasks. And despite some inaccuracies due to the limitation of their equipment, we're obviously talking about the medical equipment, nothing more sinister than that, they were fine physicians and were unrivaled until the Islamic Golden Age.
Yeah.
Ancient Egyptians' medicine, basically, it outstripped both the Romans and the Greeks in the level of knowledge and its sophistication,
which is
fascinating.
They went backwards,
yeah.
Archaeologists have discovered papyri that shows that the Egyptians had a good knowledge of bone structure and had some understanding of breathing, the pulse, the brain and the liver, all favourites of us, of course. The Egyptians developed a theory of physiology that saw the heart as the centre of a system of 46, very specific, tubes or channels. They failed, though, to realise that the different tubes, like veins, intestines, lungs, that sort of thing, had specific purposes. Their system is called the channel theory by medical historians.
Now, despite their knowledge, or perhaps because of it, now, due to it, the outstanding complexity of it all, the Egyptians believed that life was created and controlled by the gods.
They did.
Of course they did. For example, they believed that their god, Thoth, created human beings, and their god, Bes, oversaw childbirth. Now, having observed the damage done to farmers' fields when an irrigation channel became blocked...
Much like a human tube can become blocked.
Yes, exactly. The Egyptians developed the idea... Again, constipation, poor Wayne. The Egyptians developed the idea that disease occurred when an evil spirit called the Wehedu blocked one of the body's channels.
Ah, so that's what's to blame.
Yeah, this was a crucial breakthrough in the history of medicine because it led doctors to abandon purely spiritual cures for illness and instead to try practical cures designed simply to unblock one of the channels.
Ah, yes, so the channels... So can we have some examples of these then? Let's cover a few of these off.
Okay, yeah.
Number one, what are these channels?
Yeah.
There are four vessels in his nostrils. This is a direct quote. Two give mucus and two give blood. Or all four give mucus in your case, Matt.
If it's the winter, that's probably the case. There are four vessels to the head, the blocking of which produces a bald spot and loss of hair.
Oh.
Wayne, and unfortunately myself as well.
I've just
recently purchased a caffeine shampoo, which I'm hoping is going to, with the history of medicine, the advancement will help me retain my hair.
Either that, or just pop a bag over your head.
Or of course, I have to shave it off, which is a bit of a shame.
Yes, of course, baldness, a very real problem today, listeners. And why are you staring at... my head. Why are you squinting at my head like that, Matt?
It's just the light was reflecting off it and it was a bit dazzling. I'm seeing things now.
Look. All I'll say, is that no grass grows on a busy street. All right? It's not my fault. My body was ravaged by massive testosterone levels at an early age. As we said earlier, I think I might have quite a strong Neanderthal gene.
Yeah,
but basically,
it would explain a lot. It would explain a lot.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it means I'm very manly, listeners. Not that I'm overly hairy.
Simple-minded.
Not that I'm overly hairy, of course. Smooth as an eel. Except for all the normal places, of course. Yeah. But picture a strategically shaved, sort of handsome chimpanzee, if you will.
We'll put a picture on Twitter of a handsomely shaved chimpanzee, if we can.
Yeah, and then picture me next to it, and you decide. That's about the best approximation. Anyway, you'll be bald one day, Matt. Just remember that.
It may not be that far away, to be honest.
Well, I've had many years to adjust to the fact, and you still have to suffer the blow to your self-esteem. bothers me. I mean, I'm fine with it. So.
I'm going for the morning. I'm going for the morning of my hair at the moment. Yeah. So it's a terrible thing.
Where are we?
Number three. I feel we've somewhat digressed the podcast to our own deep
number three next,
paranoias.
Next channel, listeners. Next channel. The breath which enters into the nose, enters into the heart and the lung, these join to the whole belly.
Yes, the diaphragm, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Number four, These are four vessels to the ears. Breath of life enters into the right ear.
Oh.
The breath of death enters into the left ear, of course.
Left ear, of course. I don't want to defame the memory of elite long-dead scholars here, but that is utter gibberish.
Right. It probably is.
Never mind, though, because number five is there are six vessels that lead to the arms. They lead to his fingers.
Hmm. Yeah, well, one for the arm, five for the fingers.
Well, I guess, yeah. Of course. Madame Palm four and her five lovely daughters.
Yeah, exactly. Sounds about right, though, yeah. There are two vessels to his testicles.
Oh, right.
It is they which give semen. Fairly obvious, I guess, but they came out and made the call.
Well, someone had to say it. All right, number seven. There are four vessels that open to the anus.
Oh, Jesus, not this again. Constipation.
It is they which cause liquid. Now, I'm not sure about this, because it is they which cause liquid and air to be produced for it. I mean, we know about the air, we know about the liquid. Now, the anus opens to every vessel to the right side and the left side in arms and legs when it is overfilled with excrement. I mean, I don't know about this. I think they're on the right track here, but I'm not sure about the arms and legs excrement thing, you know? Doesn't seem right, does it?
Do they just mean it just... Well, it fires out.
You fill up, and when it gets to a certain level, out it pops, sort of thing, you know?
Well, that's true. Hopefully, it's not always the way, but hopefully in a controlled manner.
Well, if there are any medical professionals listening, why not write in and tell us if there are indeed four anus vessels or not?
Yeah, okay. So this is, as we say, we're reading from an Egyptian... Yeah. Text.
This is okay? not our
this
opinion.
Is, this is an ancient Egyptian understanding of this. Okay. Okay, so I think we get the idea, right? It is clear that the Egyptians had a good basic knowledge of physiology and were therefore able to develop a proper medical profession.
Eating animal dung, hello.
Well, granted, yes. Well, remember, it's an ointment. Rub it on yourself. But again, even that... Yeah, somewhat suspect. I don't see it being subscribed nowadays. But the enthusiastic eating of various animal dung was a blot on their record. But they are not perfect, right? It was thousands of years ago. They only had a partial knowledge and got things very wrong. But it was a good start.
Yeah, they did very well. The Egyptians were good at practical first aid, though, Matt. They could reset dislocated joints. They could mend broken bones, as we said earlier.
Yeah.
As long as the problem was on the surface of the skin, Egyptian surgery could deal with it quite effectively. Egyptian doctors were excellent, not excrement, at bandaging. We know that they bound willow leaves. Remember we talked about the willow leaves earlier?
Yes, yeah, they're great antiseptic properties, of course.
Yeah, they bandaged those into the bandages of patients with inflamed wounds, for example. Willow bark is a mild painkiller too. If you injure yourself, listeners, why not try sucking on a willow tree? Or sellotape a few willow leaves to your face to deal with acne. It's perfectly socially acceptable.
Go out with that on a Friday night. The Egyptians could also stitch wounds. Archaeologists have found stone carvings in Egypt showing surgical instruments. And there are Egyptians papyri which speak of surgery, essentially. Egyptian surgery, however, did not venture inside the body. So where now? Where do we go? I think we covered the Egyptians pretty well.
What is the next forward?
I happen to know of a cheeky little Greek scholar called Hippocrates. And he was known as the father of modern medicine.
He was.
So ancient Greece would seem like a good candidate for our next stage in the medicinal development throughout history.
Yes, of course. In fact... Hippocrates is a tricky one.
Yeah.
Established a medical school in Kos.
Good old Kos. Been there on holidays. Yeah. Very nice. Good beaches.
He and his students documented numerous illnesses in the Hippocratic corpus and indeed developed the Hippocratic Oath for physicians, which is still in use today, as which we said
we,
earlier.
We talked about that earlier, didn't we? Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, medical history is riddled, Matt, with Greek scholars.
The Egyptians, of course, had done a great deal to improve medical know-how.
Very good.
But disease was still a very serious problem for the Greeks. But I guess we will not get there, listeners, this time on Historical, because that will all come to fruition in episode 2 of The History of Medicine.
Yes, on that tantalising note, listeners, we'll leave it there. The next episode coming up, which is part 2, of course, will detail Greek medicine, go into some of the crazy days of medieval treatment. Oh boy, was it medieval.
That must be terrible.
And of course, hit the hilarious Victorian medical times.
And then probably take ourselves up to some of the amazing breakthroughs of modern times.
So until next time, which hopefully will be sooner rather than later.
Yes, and keep those messages coming in, please. We've enjoyed all your suggestions and, we always do appreciate getting a message from you guys. And so
just to remind you guys that if you want to send us an email on quite literally anything, it can be a suggestion for a topic for us to cover in the future. It can just be to say, hi guys,
we're out there, we're listening to you.
Yeah.
We dislike what you do, or we like, preferably, yes, what we like what you do.
Yeah, please send us emails saying that you like us.
Yes, please. Or, actually, the other thing is, we would like to get a few more positive comments on iTunes, if we can, because what that does is it boosts us up the iTunes sort of league rankings table, and it also means that when you do a search on iTunes, you're likely to come up with Historical. We've noticed it's actually quite difficult to find us sometimes, probably because the name Historical is quite complex. Probably didn't think about that when we came up with the name. But again, if you feel generous to write us a review, we would really appreciate that.
We would, and our email address to contact us is historical@hotmail.com. Remember, Historical is with COOL, just to make it slightly more confusing.
And on Twitter, we have Historical Pod. And if you want to find us on Twitter.
And we're on Facebook, of course. If you want to download MP3s directly, go to our website. You can just Google Historical Podcast and you will see it there. Okay, so anything else to add, Matt?
Well, maybe we should finish on a joke.
Oh, lovely.
The good old doctor joke. Okay. So, yeah. Doctor, I feel like a pair of curtains.
Well, that's very worrying, and I think I'm going to actually have you sectioned under the Mental Health Act as danger to the public, so...
Oh, dear.
Until next time, listeners, thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye!